everyone. Welcome to another episode of Repeak. We are a show about remakes, reboots, and revivals because nothing is original anymore. My name is Diana Olympia.
And I'm Stephanie Kim. Today, we're chatting about the new Netflix series Bridgerton and Julia Quinn's iconic novel that inspired it all, The Duke and I. But first, news. There is a team of Nigerian teens and kids in their early 20s making these epic sci-fi short films. And one of them was like a Star Wars retelling kind of thing. And they make these using their phones, learning how to make makeshift green screens from YouTube. And the films are actually really, really good. And they were so good that they got the attention of J.J. Abrams. And J.J. Abrams sent them some film equipment. So I just thought that was so cool.
Very cute.
Yeah. And one of the Nigerian little girls specifically said that she wanted her lightsaber to be pink. And her family members were like, no, lightsabers aren't pink. And then she was like, but I want mine to be pink. And then she had a pink lightsaber. And I was just like, yes, girl.
Yeah, I thought that was nice because as we've kind of talked about a lot in terms of who was telling the story?
Yeah.
Matters so much. And it's a heartwarming story that we should fill ourselves up with more in 2021. Happy 2021, by the way.
Happy 2021, you guys. We made it.
We made it. Thank God.
We survived, in the great words of Taylor Swift. Speaking of Taylor Swift, though, not to get too off track, but I do have an update from our Evermore session.
Okay. Oh, okay. Yes. Let's do a check-in.
A repeat sneaked up on me, and it's champagne problems.
Really?
Yeah.
Tell me why, or like what parts of it, or like what has changed?
I've literally had it on repeat all weekend, and I think it's the piano is very soothing, and I really like the verses, the way the verses are written. I'm still not a fan of the chorus and the champagne problems, but I like the verses enough that it kind of lulls me into this calmness that I wasn't expecting, so it definitely grew on me, and I think it might be my favorite song on the album now.
Okay.
I mean, I still stick to my I think Evermore is better than Folklore stance so far. But yeah, this was a surprise for me. Have there been any surprises for you since listening?
No, I've actually still been pretty on track to the ones that I've called out. No changes for me.
Okay. Well, speaking of Taylor Swift, this is like a natural segue into Bridgerton because a cover of the Taylor Swift song makes a cameo in Bridgerton in the most brilliant way. So why don't we just head into our spotlight?
Our spotlight today is Bridgerton on Netflix that dropped on Christmas Day. It is a sexy Regency-era romance that follows the eldest Bridgerton daughter, Daphne, one of eight highborn siblings, as she comes out to London society in search of a husband. With her prospects quickly dwindling, Daphne enters into a sly faux romance with the sought-after Duke of Hastings to attract more suitors. Based on the beloved Bridgerton series of novels by number one New York Times bestselling author Julia Quinn, a lot of people have made the comparison that it's Gossip Girl meets Pride and Prejudice. I would also throw in To All the Boys, given the faux romance aspect of it. Lots of corsets, but it's done in a very modern way, as you kind of alluded to. They definitely make use of contemporary pop songs, typically love songs, but typically in a string quartet fashion. It very much reminded me of, I feel like, a trend that's been happening at weddings in like the last 5 to 10 years, where, I don't know about you, but I've definitely attended weddings where you're sitting down waiting for dinner to be served and they're playing a bunch of pop covers and it's all orchestra style.
I want that at my wedding.
It's fun. Notably, the song that I think got the most attention, it is in the pilot, is Thank You Next by Ariana Grande, of course. I believe it's the first song that gets played out of the covers. It was pretty delightful. I kind of wished it was more of a surprise. I didn't watch the show right away. I had a few other things in my queue. And so I did see some stuff on the internet before. But was it a surprise to you? What were your thoughts on the music?
Yeah, it was a complete and a total surprise to me. As I think I mentioned on a previous pod that I waited up until midnight on Christmas night like a crazy person to try and watch this as soon as it dropped because I was really excited. Previously before that, all I really had watched were the trailers. I don't even think it really clicked in with me until maybe like the week before that this was actually based on Julia Quinn novels, which is significant for me because I used to work for a publisher. I did not work with her and I did not work closely on any of her books, but it's just sort of like a point of pride. It's kind of like that feeling you get when, remember the Thor Ragnarok trailer? When Chris Hemsworth gets in the arena with Hulk and he's like, hey, that's a friend from work. I know him. Like, that was the kind of feeling I got. Like, oh, like I know this author and it's cool. Anyway, that's all to say, I didn't really know anything going into it, so it was super fresh and just expecting to see high quality Shonda level drama and romance. And then this music came on and I was fucking delighted. It was so good. I thought it was such a nice way to add a fresh modern element to it. And then I thought it was really fun as like the other covers came along. I wish they had picked different songs sometimes, but I really, really loved that they were trying to infuse some modern energy into it. And this was the way that they did it. I thought it was a stroke of genius for sure.
Yeah, for sure. I wanted to get your thoughts because you're definitely much more an expert on this stuff than me. And I think it'll set an interesting framework to our discussion. But, you know, the Julia Quinn novels, as I understand them, are, quote, romance novels in terms of a category if we had to pick them. Mm-hmm. You mentioned to me, I think it was offline, you know, recently, that romance novels have, I guess, certain rules or specific things that are associated with them. Could you help us, mostly me, understand that a little bit? Like, what makes a book a romance novel?
For sure. So just to let our listeners know, I read the book and I watched the series, and then Dio's watched the series and we're comparing notes. And just, you know, in case anybody hasn't watched the show yet or had a chance to read the book, our conversation will and always is spoiler heavy. So be warned. But I'm certainly not an expert in romance novels. I did work on a couple of romance novels as a publicist very briefly at the beginning of my career, but my expertise certainly isn't super deep. But one of my really good friends loves romance novels. She's read them for years. And so I've heard about them from her and why she loves them. And she always, you know, told me and let me know that for a book to be considered a romance or in the romance genre, it has to have a love story at the center of it, which seems a little obvious, but that's still one of the rules. And it has to have a happily ever after. Those are the two rules. So everybody who loves and reads romance, they are used to having like a tidy end to each novel. And most romance novels before the Bridgerton series came up were very much contained. You could read one as a standalone and kind of like be done. When I was reading up on this series and when I was reading The Duke and I, the thing that made this one a little bit different is that she basically created an MCU for romance novels. It follows the Bridgerton family. It's a family of 8 kids. They're of highborn status, and it follows each child as they go through London society and find their lovers. There are certainly other very iconic romance series and families, but this is like one of the most beloved ones for sure.
But what about the bodice ripping? Talk about that.
Okay, so bodice ripper is a very derogatory term that was used in the 70s, I believe, when there were a lot more controversial sex scenes. And that is not a term that I believe that the romance community now endorses or backs up in any way. So that term is very much considered a derogatory term that we don't use anymore. Except for the fact that there is a store in LA, an independent bookstore in LA called The Ripped Bodice, but it is what it is.
And so what would you say is a more acceptable term to describe what seems to be, you didn't list it out as a rule, but at least from an outsider's perspective, does seem to be another component to these novels?
What do you mean by component?
Sex scenes. Steamy sex scenes.
Okay. A lot of romance novels do have graphic sex in them, but not all of them. And of course, there are, you know, YA love stories that are categorized as romances as well. And those don't tend to have as much sex, but it really just varies based on what kind of romance you're reading. And then There are different subgenres like paranormal romance, historical romance like the Bridgerton series. There's contemporary. But yeah, like, so sex has always been a part of romance novels. It's not always been super PC. And I think you'll see that both in the show and in The Duke and I as well. There is one very controversial sex scene there, but just kind of par for the course in this genre.
And so going back to the term, quote, bodice ripping, it sounds like the main reason that that's not kosher is because maybe in the past, these kinds of scenes in romance novels, there were questions of consent or...
Yeah. Again, I'm not an expert, but my understanding is that the older romance novels, the ones in the 70s, had a lot of scenes in which the female characters in particular did not consent to certain things. And that's how the term bodice ripper came about.
And so let's just segue into that scene that you mentioned. So I have read a little bit of The Duke and Ike. I just got it through my library like 2 days ago, but I haven't been able to scrub to that section in the book, but I did find it online, a very small excerpt. So I read how it was written and I've seen the show, but you've read the whole book. What are your thoughts on, I guess we should describe the scene and then what are your thoughts on it?
Okay, so the scene is basically before they end up getting married, the Duke confides in Daphne that he cannot have children and he knows that that's something that she wants. And so that's why he was refusing to marry her before. But now that she knows this, she agrees to marry him. And they are kind of both in the position where, like, they have to get married or her good name will be sullied in society. The big controversy, so they get married. And then later on, because she doesn't know anything about sex, she realizes that it's not that he is incapable of having a child. It's that he has been pulling out during sex. Which, you know, has all of its other implications. So she gets very upset about this, understandably, because he, in effect, lied to her by saying that he couldn't have children. In the book, it's a lot more gray, blurred linesy in that he comes home drunk and she sort of realizes that she could have her way with him in this moment. But he is also awake and sort of like, wants to have sex with her because, you know, he's drunk. And then they proceed to make love and she forces him to, sorry, mom, come inside of her. and yeah, and that's what happens. And it feels very date rapey and very, the lines are very gray, but she is sober and he is drunk and it's a very uncomfortable situation. And then in the show, both characters are very sober, but she basically coerces him again. They both want to have sex, but she coerces him into coming inside of her. And then they have a fight. So yeah, that's what happened. And it's uncomfortable. People don't like it. It's a very controversial scene in the book. And it's uncomfortable in the show. And I kind of wish they had changed it more in the show, but they didn't.
Do you think you wish they had made it less ambiguous or?
I do think they made it like way less ambiguous in the show because nobody is under the influence of any alcohol or drug. It made me uncomfortable that she was essentially, I don't know, they didn't coerce each other into having sex, but she definitely, she was on top of him and pinned him down and like, made him climax and when he wasn't comfortable with that. And I don't know what the right plotting would have been to go for instead, but I think there was a way to maybe not do that.
Yeah. As soon as she has the maid explain to her how exactly a baby is made and she kind of has a light bulb, I kind of thought they were going to go a little bit soap opera, daytime soap opera line of plot because she starts to have the realization when he grabs a tissue, like the time before they had sex. Mm-hmm. And so I thought she was just going to basically wait until they finished and then like grab the tissue and then somehow try to like inseminate herself or something.
Ew.
Like that. So in some ways, this was much darker and in that way more interesting because I think, and the showrunner definitely talks about this a lot, but how in his mind, he kind of titled this season The Education of Daphne Bridgerton. And so they very much try to portray her as this innocent, doe-like young woman who's they say it several times, just barely out of her leading strings. And she clearly has not been educated by her mother about marital relations or really any sort of physical intimacy relations with men. Simon is actually the one in the show. I don't know how it happens in the book, but he's the one who teaches her about self-pleasure while they're fake courting. And so the fact that she goes from not knowing anything to then taking this line of action to get what she wants, I thought was really interesting. I thought it was a very powerful show focused on desire and desperation. You know, it's the desperation of mothers to get their daughters married and to have their futures secured, including Marina, in a sense, the cousin of the Featheringtons, who apparently in the books is actually a cousin of the Bridgertons. But even her, the things that she decides to do and takes a bit far, you know, she does because she is doing what she feels like is best for her family. And so for Daphne, her main character drive is that she wants a family. And so it's interesting to depict it in this way, the lengths that she'll go, someone who used to be so innocent, in order to secure that future that she wants for herself. So I agree, it's definitely uncomfortable. And the questions of consent should absolutely be raised. I think from a character level, I did find it an interesting and almost necessary push to really show how the character has been stretched from when we first met her.
Yeah, I see your point there. I just, from a character perspective, after that happens, I don't really understand, other than knowing ahead of time that there is a certain rule and that they have to end up together at the end. I don't understand how you come back from that as a couple and are like, I trust you again. For both sides too, like, I don't understand, like, how she would. I feel like his betrayal is very deep and, like, drives her to that place, and I think it is interesting that they went there, but also her doing that to him, say this were like a regular drama series or something and not based on a romance novel, I just don't think you come back from that.
Yeah, and I'm curious to get your thoughts on the timeline, so to speak, in the TV series. It's 8 episodes, coincidentally, mm-hmm. for the 8 children. Has nothing to do with the other, but first of all, I thought that was an interesting number. I kind of liked it going into it because I was like, oh, it's like very BBC like it's nice and tight. Hopefully it won't be too stretched out. But I will say, upon watching, I sort of felt like the plot movement was a bit uneven. At times it felt like it was moving very quickly, which is partly the times, you know. There's basically this London season where all the marriageable women are of age, and so they get paraded around at different balls until they find a match, and then they're pretty much, you know, the head of the household, who's a man, does the deal with the suitor, and that's it. They're married, they leave. So in some ways, that made sense why some of these things move so quickly. But then there would be other moments where the main conflict with Daphne and Simon would be kind of at a lull moment, and so then they'd kind of like try to fill it with other things, and it just kind of felt, I don't know what the better word is or another word to use other than uneven, but so including, to your point, how this is resolved, how they go from making this almost unforgivable sin of leading someone on to think that you're impotent, basically, instead of telling them that you choose not to have children because of a vow revenge situation you have with your father, and her taking advantage of a situation to get what she wants, to, spoiler alert, her basically convincing him, like, hey, leave your daddy issues behind. I love you. I know you're not perfect, but I love you anyway. Like, let's have children. And then he's like, okay, cool. And then they end up, according to Wikipedia or Romancepedia, having 5 children.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Like, in the show, it basically happens over, I think, a couple days. Like, they host a ball and she gives this Meredith Grey version of Pick Me, Choose Me, Love Me mm-hmm. speech. And then he gets a little push from Lady Danbury, who's kind of his surrogate mother. And then kind of all is well. How does it happen pretty closely in the book?
So the book is very different. And I think that this is one of the more interesting points. And we talk about this all the time with book to film adaptations, because with a book to film adaptation, they have to adapt the book to the medium they're telling it for. And the thing that's tricky about romance, and my friend was saying this too, is that a lot of the drama in romance comes from internal conflict, and you're often inside of the main character's heads the whole time. The book is much more contained, and it's much more, everything is much more centralized. It's very much just about Daphne and the Duke. The other siblings are kind of barely there. They're there, and I think that a lot of them are a lot more endearing in the book, in my opinion, but that's neither here nor there. But the Featheringtons are barely in the book at all. It really is about the Duke and Daphne's courtship. Marina is not in book one. And so it's just much more focused on the couple, and they're kind of pining for each other, and they're courting each other and what they're thinking. And the book definitely goes back and forth between Simon's perspective and Daphne's perspective. And so it's just a whole different ballgame in general, because I could tell from the pilot that they had to weave in so many more external conflicts because it's a show and you have to be able to see everything that's happening. And you can't just watch two people kind of like sitting in two separate rooms thinking about how much they love each other, because that just doesn't work. And so you can definitely feel that. You can feel that in the pilot, and you can feel that, like you said, the pacing is a little bit off because of all the different plot lines they had to bring in. The prince is not in the book at all. The blonde debutante that is kind of like Daphne's foe during the courting season is not in the book at all. Like I said, Marina is not in the book at all. So they really had to work to flush out all these other characters. And each book is based on a different sibling. So it is very much like a Marvel Cinematic Universe, in that like the next book is about Antony and his love story. The next book is about Benedict and, I think, and his love story. And then you go into Eloise and things like that. Eloise is like barely in the first book at all. But I think the pacing has issues because they tried to like bring all this stuff in all at once, because they're trying to set up for other seasons.
That makes sense. I guess my question is, do you think it would have been better, knowing that this internally, it sounds like Ted Sarandos and even Betsy Beers had some concerns about the show being successful and having, I don't know, maybe a broad enough reach, which at least Betsy has, you know, said she was completely wrong. It feels like from an outsider's perspective, especially viewing this as a Shondaland production, that this was inevitably going to be successful and have many seasons. Do you think it would have been better that they just stretched out all the storylines across multiple seasons instead of treating it like the books and trying to encapsulate the tidy storylines? Or do you think that was trying to be in service of how the novels, especially the genre, acts, which is that it needs a tidy ending at the end of each season? Because to your point, they're setting everything up. So in theory, they could have started kind of planting the seeds for everyone's stories, although, you know, they'd probably have to work around timing because the children are of different ages, of course. But what are your thoughts on that?
Well, first, your comment about the Ted Sarandos and the other executive not thinking that this show was going to be a success, I think that that is very much a product of people underestimating the romance community and people who love romance and read it. And because the people who love romance, they read it a lot. There are a lot of people out there who have been reading romance for years. And I think it's kind of like an insulting, underestimating women kind of thing, and like the content made for women. So it just also comes back to people labeling romance as smut or like bodice rippers or, you know, guilty pleasures that people shouldn't really read, or just kind of like insulting to me. And I think that if those people had really taken the time to understand the market and the fandom that surrounds Julia Quinn in these novels, and on top of that, you know, had faith in the Shondaland machine, which those two things together are huge, of course this is going to be a hit, in my opinion. I don't know, in terms of how they set up the seasons, I feel like they did what they did because they had to for the medium. And I'm not sure that this would have worked as well if it had been a solely Daphne and Simon focused season, because I think you could have ended it in two episodes. Like, I feel like it could have just been a movie then, and they could have done other family things. So I understand why they tried to add more layers to the world. But I think they had trouble balancing it at different points. And that's what you were feeling.
Yeah, I wouldn't have wanted it to be just them the whole season. I would have liked for them to choose a midpoint to be the cliffhanger for season one and flesh out the other storylines simultaneously so that we have more even amounts of conflict, not just, you know, we're focused on Daphne and Simon, and when they're happy having sex everywhere all over Cliveden, like, let's fit in somebody else, you know, so that everyone has almost equal weight of tension and stakes. That way you don't feel like you're just watching what's clearly the B plot line.
But I thought they did do that. You didn't think they did that? Because I felt like they definitely did do that with all of the Marina stuff and the stuff with the Queen and Penn and Eloise. All that stuff is not in the book at all.
Yeah, I mean, I did. And maybe it's a different perspective from reading the book, because that is so much so just them. But just from the tone of just like the balancing act seems like slightly off. I'm sure they did the best that they could. You know, adaptations are not easy. Certainly when you're working with an eight series long novel franchise with and creating new characters. I know they created brand new characters. So, you know, I wasn't supremely disappointed by it, but some of the pauses in tension, I guess, left me wanting more. Another thing that left me wanting more that I want to get your thoughts on was the race of it all. You know, I appreciated, obviously, the casting of Simon, who in the book is clearly white with black hair and blue eyes, casting him as a black man in the show, having Queen Charlotte be black, and them citing the fact that there are historical, allusions to perhaps that she was mixed race, the relative prominence of Lady Danbury. I thought it was a bit precarious because a lot of people have brought up Cinderella 1997, which we've covered on this show, and how colorblind casting that was and what a feat that was back in 1997. Someone asked me whether they brought up race on the show or not, and they do a little, and I kind of almost wish they, you know, I tend to be binary, which is something I'm working on, but I think the all or nothing proposition is what nags at me, because I feel like they kind of talk to race a smidge bit. There's that conversation between Simon and Lady Danbury where she's basically saying, don't, you know, you're taking your life for granted. The fact that the queen is black is good for us. She doesn't say it in such blunt words, but that's clearly what she's referring to. It felt very tiptoey. And I think there's an argument to be made for both. Either you include, you know, different faces, different colors, and you don't make a big deal about it because that's just the world we live in. And why do we need to talk about it so much? On the other hand, to act as if it doesn't matter at all and doesn't have consequences, or not consequences even, or just doesn't have some sort of impact, I think is also naive. So I'm torn. I do hope that in future seasons they're able to find some way to maybe discuss it in a more meaningful way. But perhaps that's also wanting too much from the genre, which is, I don't know, what are your thoughts on that? Like, when it comes to genres, like, are there different expectations we should have for what we can expect on certain topics?
It's tricky. It's funny you bring up the 1997 Cinderella, because I actually was impressed that they acknowledged the race at all in this series, that that Simon had that conversation with Lady Danbury. Obviously in the books, or maybe not obviously, but in the books, everybody is white, and romance has notoriously been, you know, not diverse at all. And they've been trying harder recently to be more diverse and inclusive, but it's just with everything in publishing too, it's going very slowly. So the fact that they casted like this at all, and they acknowledged race, and that it wasn't just like a blind casting thing that like they did in Cinderella, I thought was a pretty big step forward. So like, I was kind of happy with that, with the way that they approached it, because at the same time, it's a romance, and not that we can't talk about heavier things, but like, for me, romance is an escape. Again, I'm only speaking for myself. I don't speak for the entire community. I'm not an expert, but if I'm reading a romance novel, I want to read or watch two people fall in love, and I don't want to have to think about really much of anything else. And so I think that the way that they acknowledged it was very appropriate, and I liked it a lot. And I love that the queen was black. The queen isn't even in the book, in the first book at all, or in the series. And so it was nice that they acknowledged that. So like, I don't really know what the right answer is for future series or seasons, but I just think that this is very much a step in the right direction. And I've seen some commentary that, you know, it's great that Simon's black, but can we really not have any dark skin leads in romances and you know, the colorism of it all, which is a totally valid point, of course. I think if I were growing up and I were to watch this when I was, if I was younger, it would mean something to me to see all these characters play highborn nobles.
Yeah, no, totally. I think the question came up for me because I've also been continuing to evaluate our discussion about Wonder Woman. I've had follow-up conversations with a few folks and even listened to a couple of podcasts, very prominent podcasts, cover it and review it with much more generous and kind eyes than we did. And it kind of made me wonder, it made me think of whether or not I was coming into that movie, Wonder Woman 1984, with too high expectations for a superhero movie. Because some of the podcasters were saying, you know, like, but come on, it's a superhero movie. What do you expect? And to me, that made me pause because I thought, but there's a part of me that says, why can't we expect more, though, of our stories? And I feel like I'm expecting more, especially of superhero genre, because there is so much money in it, because so many people spend money to see it. And I feel like they have an obligation to ensure that it's still a good story at the end of the day. But it made me question whether or not I just have too high expectations for story across genre and I'm not taking that to account, and whether or not that should be a limiting factor to say, hey, but this is young adult or this is romance or this is superhero, and therefore you cannot expect the same type of stories to be told at certain levels. But I wasn't sure if that was, I don't know, I just wanted an outside thought on that.
No, yeah, I think that's totally fair. And I'd be curious to hear what the general takeaway was. I mean, you mentioned that they were a lot kinder than we were on the Wonder Woman front. I think the thing for me that felt weird about the Wonder Woman thing is that they didn't acknowledge it at all. And so I think in Bridgerton, I liked that Lady Danbury and Simon had that conversation. And you're like, oh, okay, so everybody is aware that this is a thing, but they also clearly are accepting of it. And in a way, I feel like that is a lot more revolutionary than just pretending like it doesn't exist. Acknowledging that the characters understand that there is a difference in skin color and that that shifts certain expectations, but then still watching this, you know, white mother push her daughter to marry this black man, that was really cool. I think that the way they handled it in Bridgerton was definitely more of a step in the right direction. And I think that that speaks to Shonda's influence and her thoughtfulness when it comes to casting and all this stuff. Because I think even going back to Grey's Anatomy, I remember Christina Yang was like the first, I mean, I don't remember seeing an Asian woman on primetime TV before Sandra Oh. There is one lady, a Korean lady on Lost, but I think, you know, she didn't really have a big role. And Christina Yang was like a massive life-changing role. And just being able to see that and knowing that Shonda was the one that really led that kind of thought and casting made me, basically, we should have more Black women in positions of power. Is my takeaway, because I think the way she does it is so much more thoughtful and carried out in a deliberate manner than the way that other people do it. Because I think Wonder Woman did feel very cut-pasty, and that's why we weren't feeling it as much. Does that make sense?
That totally makes sense. And by the way, neither of them even brought up the race thing. They were just more kind to the movie in general, that I was kind of taken aback based on our discussion. But no, I totally hear your point, and I think I absolutely agree. More Black women should be in charge. I think they have a much wider perspective on things. And we've already seen the fruit of their labor, including, you know, Ava DuVernay and many other women. Regina King is directing her first movie this year, One Night in Miami. So I think that's really exciting. I guess, you know, I think for people of color, we're always going to be in want of more. I think progress is never going to happen as fast as we want it to. And so I think that's what I find myself with is seeing a dip in the water and me wanting them to just jump in. And I think that's just, you know, obviously maybe beyond the bandwidth right now of the industry. But let's talk about something a little bit more basic that we always love to discuss. Chemistry. Do you think the actors playing Daphne and Simon had chemistry? Yes or no?
Okay, so I'm kind of torn on this issue. At first, I felt like no. Because at first, what was carrying me through the show was, God damn, Reggae is hot. He's so hot.
So hot.
And that was like all I cared about, was that he was so beautiful. And so I didn't really think they had great chemistry until I got to episode 3 and they are, you know, that scene where they're like staring at the painting and their hands slowly touch. And it's just like, oh my God, I thought I really loved that scene. And that's when I kind of fell in love with them. But I have to say, and this is where the difficulty translating book to film comes into play again, is that the chemistry is much more instant and apparent in the book because their meeting is they meet pretty quickly in the book, and they meet during that scene where she punches Nigel in the face. And it's the first scene, I'm pretty sure it's told from the Duke's perspective, and he's very much, you can like hear what he's thinking, obviously, and that he's very attracted to her. And that doesn't really come across with Simon until much later in the show. And I think that that is, you know, a decision that Reggae made when acting. But I think in the book, it's a lot easier because Julia Quinn just writes that he has an icy exterior, but really he's like super intrigued by her and wants to take her right away and all this stuff. And so it's just different. What did you think?
Yeah, I read that. I got to that scene in the book. And to your earlier point, depicting the story on screen does have a disadvantage for the lack of interior monologue, unless you want to go the voiceover route, which has been overdone a lot. So please don't.
Which they technically did still with Julie Andrews and Lady Whistledown, but
that's true. Yeah. But you know, obviously with the characters themselves, and yes, reading how that scene, their meet cute in the book is quite different, and you do get much more a sense of his attraction to her immediately, like at a high level. It starts kind of coy, like it's actually quite a long scene in the series.
Yeah, it's really
they bump into each other very quickly, and then I think they don't really have a sustained conversation until like a little bit later in the episode, if I recall. But in the book, it's actually quite long. It's funny because their whole discussion is happening while this guy is on the ground, the suitor she just basically punched in the face, and they start by debating like what to do with him, and then yeah, it just turns into this very long conversation. And when I was reading it, I thought, how is he not woken up yet? And at some point he does rouse again, and like he basically ends up punching him. And so they continue their conversation. It was a very long, very long meet cute.
It's so funny.
But yeah, the attraction was very intense from him at the start. It kind of grows throughout that interaction. It goes from like intrigue to like to what he refers to later is straight up lust. But on the show itself, in terms of their chemistry, I wavered. There were definitely moments where I kind of felt it. People debate the I burn for you scene and whether or not there was heat.
I want to talk about that. Let's break for a second and then we'll talk about I burn for you. You were talking about I burn for you.
Yeah, so there's debate over that scene whether or not there's heat there or not. I felt it a little bit. What I think happened is that Reggae is really carrying the chemistry mostly. I'm gonna forget who tweeted this, but I'll try to find it later. But we've also said this, I've said this plenty of times for sure, that, you know, a lot of the chemistry is coming from how the characters are looking at each other, if they're able to sustain a spark without speaking. And I think he's doing most of the legwork here. As is the case in many Regency era content, the main woman is usually quite plain looking, not beautiful, but it's just like the style. So it was kind of a little hard to feel like they were a match because he's an 11, as I said to people, and she is a 10 somewhere, but not in this world. And again, not a dig at the actress. I'm sure she's
drop dead gorgeous, beautiful.
But she is made to look plain and, you know, very tidy and presentable and look like a lady. But ladies don't look hot. Like the soprano singer who Anthony is having sex with, she's hot. She's got the dark eye makeup. She's wearing the voluptuous things. The ladies are not meant to look hot. They're meant to look pretty, right? So I think it was a little hard to kind of feel the heat in those moments. But once he teases her about sex and they're like frolicking all over Cliveden, just literally having sex in every corner of the estate, it feels more palpable. Because then every time they lock eyes, you're like, oh my God, are they going to do it again? And I wrote down in my notes, at this rate, how are they not going to have children? They're literally just like having sex all the time once they're married. It's crazy and comical. And the picnic scene was unnecessary, but very funny. They don't even describe that in the book, by the way. They just talk about how they didn't leave their honey, like their suite for a week, but they don't mention that they have sex in the library, that they have sex on a ladder, on a picnic blanket, in a gazebo, none of that. So that is all the show.
I love that so much.
Yeah. So I thought he carried it. It was believable during, most especially during kind of the love scenes, but I think it's mostly attributed to him.
So that's interesting because I really liked Daphne. I like Daphne as a character. Did I think their chemistry was off the charts? No. But do I think that they are both gorgeous people and do I want them to be together and happy? Yes, because he is really pretty. And so is she. I think her wig is not doing her any favors, but it is what it is. And all I can think of is the string quartet version of Wildest Dreams playing while, like, you see Reggae's butt cheeks in the field. And it's, like, the most glorious scene I've ever – it's, like, one of my favorite scenes of television, I think. But there is a lot of sex in the book after that point. And I just think it's kind of, like, part of the format of romance. There's just, like, a lot of just wanting until the two characters finally get together. And then once – they get together, they have sex a lot.
So it's like a Korean drama, but without the sex. Because that's
yeah,
very much similar format for those of you who've never seen one. It's 16 episodes of like, oh my God, our pinkies grazed each other.
Yeah.
There's a really funny meme of somebody watching, I think like a show on USA where they're having like the main characters are having sex in the first episode and he looks disgusted. And then it's of him watching like episode 16 of a Korean drama where the couple like holds hands or like embraces and he like starts crying. It's really funny and very apt for anybody who's ever been indoctrinated in the genre.
Yes. And one thing I was watching an interview with Phoebe, the lead actress who plays Daphne, and she said that the sex was important because it's very much her sexual awakening and the whole show is told from a female gaze, and that is quietly very feminist and different because we see male gaze all the fucking time. The fact that we never really see her naked, but we see him, I mean, I guess there's one really quick shot of her naked when they're in bed together. But mostly it's like his butt and it's Anthony's butt as well. So I'm like, cool. Like, I appreciate this. Good for you guys.
Show for women by women. Well, yes. Sort of. Let's talk about the feminism of it all. I'm curious if you could speak a little bit as to how you feel like it presents or doesn't present itself in the book. I've only read a couple of chapters, so I don't really have a good grasp on how it plays as a factor or not. In the show, it's definitely felt in a lot of subtle ways and in a lot of not subtle ways. What was your take on the book?
Well, I think Julia Quinn is definitely writes from a feminist lens. Like even the meet cute in the book when you see Daphne punching Nigel, it's like Simon's having this internal monologue before she punches Nigel and saying, should I go rescue her or not? Do I want to get into this? And then he decides that he's gonna get into it. And then she ends up punching him and he's like, well, you didn't really need saving after all. And so she is very much, it's still Regency era and it's still women are very much treated like property and that sucks, but she's doing what she can within the confines of the time period and the genre to make it as feminist as possible.
And so in terms of, because, you know, a lot of the characters or some of the characters that are shown as having agency or trying to empower themselves to make decisions that affect their lives and the lives of their future, you know, children, Marina as an example, you know, those characters don't exist in the book. So I guess I was curious if that empowerment and agency outside of that first scene is continued throughout. Because, you know, Lady Danbury, Lady Bridgerton kind of try to take matters into their own hand, unbeknownst to them that the children have already kind of made this arrangement themselves, but they kind of scheme to try to get the children together. You know, Penelope ends up manipulating her mom a little bit to kind of keep Colin in play. You know, there's lots of scenes of women trying to take control of their own lives. And I guess I'm curious how that's depicted in the book, considering that, you know, it is mostly focused on Daphne and Simon, and there aren't really any other characters.
I think it's definitely more subtle in the book. And I think one of the scenes that I'm thinking of is, well, there are two scenes, and they both have to do with Daphne's brothers. The first one is that actually in the beginning of the book, Daphne has already rejected 4 or 5 marriage proposals, and Nigel's is one of them. And Antony is just like, well, you know, she doesn't want to. So like, whatever, I'll just decline on her behalf. And I think somebody, I can't remember if it was Simon or somebody else, but they were like, oh, that's nice of you to do that for your sister, because it's clearly abnormal during that time to allow a woman to decline a man. And he was like, well, she's been a good sister, so I'm just going to let her do what she wants. And then there is also a scene at the end when after the controversial sex scene and after Daphne and Simon have had their fight and they're kind of on the rocks, and she goes back to London, and she is away from Simon for a while, and Simon ends up going after her, and they are back at Hastings' house in London, and 3 of her brothers have shown up, Antony, Benedict, and Colin, to defend Daphne's honor and just kick the living shit out of Simon. And it's a really funny scene, very endearing. I loved it. But then she is basically like, get out. It's like, this is my marriage, and this is my problem, and like, you guys have no right to be here. And she like apologizes to Simon, and she's like, I'm so sorry, they're in your house. And he's like, this is our house. That's when he tells her that he loves her, but like, not in front of them for their sake. Like, he pulls her aside and does that. So there are just like subtle things like that that she put in there that I appreciated.
Yeah. You know, I do think that it is, again, subtle and not subtle ways that they show it in the TV series. But I do like the many times that they offer the women a choice. It's pretty clear, but it's not like so like, look at me, I'm giving the woman choice. But, you know, different from how you described in the book, Antony is much more kind of the overbearing brother who basically is the reason why she doesn't really have any suitors. He's kind of scaring them all away. This is her first season on the market, as opposed to in the book where it's 2 years have gone by. And, you know, he initially tries to arrange that Nigel Burbrook marriage. It goes awry. And then the prince of Prussia, who doesn't exist in the book, he becomes a potential suitor, and he asked Antony for her hand. And he basically reports back to the household, and they say, what did you tell him? And he said, well, I know better than to make that decision for my sister. And so I told him to ask you himself. So I think, you know, I really enjoyed those moments where maybe at the beginning, the men didn't really understand, and they've come to kind of respect the women for clearly wanting control of their own lives again. So I really enjoy those moments. Something you mentioned, which I think kind of goes along this line of feminism, which we've seen in other Regency era books, and most notably, I got Little Women vibes and Booksmart vibes from the characters of Penelope and Eloise. Yeah, just talk about how you felt about those characters.
I love Eloise. She's my favorite. I think Eloise and Pen and Lady Danbury were definitely my favorite characters in the show. I was rewatching episodes today, and all of Eloise's facial expressions are amazing. They're so good. She's so funny. I love that she wants to be her own woman, and she's super frustrated and because of the times, and she just has these really funny, quippy one-liners. And even there's this one scene at the end of the season where she's eating a box of chocolates and she's like, I do not share my food. And then her 2 brothers come up and like make her share her candy. And she's just like, whatever, you guys, she's the best. I have a question for you. How do you feel about, again, spoiler, Pen being revealed as Lady Whistledown? And do you think that was obvious? Because that doesn't happen in the books. Lady Whistledown isn't revealed in the books until book 4.
But it is the same person in the book, right?
Yes.
Okay. So I was surprised. Maybe I shouldn't have been. I definitely didn't think it was the Modiste, because it felt like that was a red herring, which it was. I started forming a theory a little bit earlier in the show that it might actually have been Lady Bridgerton. I started forming this theory when Eloise was thinking that it was a widow, and they were trying to make it seem like it was Lady, I believe it's Drawbridge. And I thought that obviously was, again, trying to point it to obviously. And so I said, wouldn't it be interesting if it was the mom? Because clearly the mom and the sisters have been a beneficiary of the kind words that Lady Whistledown has had for the Bridgertons. And it wouldn't be surprising that she'd be not so nice about the Featheringtons. The Eloise discovers one of the maids downstairs with a bunch of Whistledowns, because at some point she also thinks it's a maid. She has many theories during the show. And so I thought, ooh, maybe, and that maid was telling Daphne's maid that your lady's happiness is basically like your only job. And so I was thinking, oh, maybe it's, you know, Lady Bridgerton's maid is like doing the writing for her and she's kind of helping. Anyways, so I thought it was her for a bit. And so I was surprised when it was Penelope. I love that it was her because, you know, for people like me who were fooled, it's unexpected. She's clearly one of the more underserved, unnoticed, purposefully characters in the series. So, and they're very much, you know, trying to throw you off the scent, where Eloise is like, oh, like we should be like her. We should figure out who she is so we can learn her secrets. And Penelope keeps pretending like, but that's not what I want. I want to be married. You know, inside she wants Colin, Eloise's brother. So I thought they did a pretty good job at trying to give you different, you know, potentials. So I would definitely love to see more of kind of how that came about in season two, maybe doing some flashbacks. I wouldn't want to just skip ahead to just following her along as she is in present day Whistledown. I'd want to see kind of what the genesis was, because she's only done it, at least it seemed like in the books, like for the last 3 months. And it seems similar in the show where it's like very much a new thing. So I'd be curious to see kind of why she chose to do it. Like what was the igniting factor, I guess. Right. So what about you? Did you figure it out?
Yeah. Well, okay. So I figured it out because I wasn't 100% sure, but when the reveal came, I wasn't surprised, only because Pen was really the only character who was spending that much time with Marina. And she was also the only character who had the motivation to out Marina the way she did, which was very, it just felt very personal for somebody to do that to Marina, to, you know, tell everybody in society that she's pregnant out of wedlock. That's a big fucking deal. And, you know, Pen made it clear that she's harboring feelings for Colin. And so that's when I kind of was like, huh, it must have been her, because she's the only one who has like a personal investment in sharing that news. And so I wasn't surprised, but I was surprised that they revealed it early, like so early in the series. I would have thought that they would have waited another season or two, but I wonder if they did that because Gossip Girl happened and everybody was super into who Gossip Girl was at those first couple of seasons, and then it just kind of like nobody cared anymore. So I wondered if that was a way to kind of negate falling into that trap.
Yeah, I'm also wondering if it was kind of their only device as a hook. Not that, you know, there was nothing else, you know, to be desired in a season two. But to your point, if they're following along the kind of the rules of the romance novel, it is pretty tidy endings. And they kind of tip the hat a little bit on what they might be previewing for next season. But there wasn't really a, oh my God, I can't wait to see what happens next. It's Colin goes off abroad, you know, Anthony's, you know, they kind of set him up to be moving on from The Soprano, but there isn't really anything major happening. So I also felt like it was a one last like shook moment to be like, oh my God, season two, I need it now kind of thing. Which I feel like most people had that reaction of like, I need more pumping into my veins.
Yeah, but how much of that is just because everybody's really pretty and everybody wants to watch people falling in love and they're our male butt cheeks? Maybe I'm the only one that's like very fixated on the male butt cheeks.
You are most certainly not. I just wanted to kind of just go down like a quick list of like other things that you liked about the show. For me, it was definitely the production quality. You could feel the money, much like in The Crown. The costumes look fucking expensive, which I love.
Yes.
I love the little dogs. I love the queens, like, palms, and that each dog has their own handler. And I loved, similarly to Cinderella 97, that it is Regency. It is kind of this like royalty, you know, far gone era, but that it's not dull. Like it's very vibrant. Also kind of similarly to the most recent Emma. The colors are very bright and vivid.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was really fun. Like that opening scene where they're just kind of going through the town. I really liked that because I think to your point with how they're doing the music, it really infuses a bit more of a modern energy and vibe to it without making it so stuffy and boring.
Yeah, I agree. I felt that too, in the brightness of it and the colors and this just the grand camera movements, how they do a lot of aerial shots to show all of the estates. And then when you're like in the estates, they pan up to see like the ceilings of everything, just so you get like the feeling of how big everything is and how opulent everything is. And the one thing that kind of threw me off, and it didn't necessarily throw me off on first viewing, but it did after, both in a positive way because I liked some of this and in a negative way because on other characters I hated this, was the hair. It was the wigs, man. It's always the wigs. I love the hair pieces that the queen wears. Like some of them are so ridiculous and amazing. And I also love that there's a one scene in season 2 where I texted my best friend and I was like, is the queen legit just snorting coke in front of Daphne's mother? And apparently no, it's powdered tobacco that she's snorting, not actual coke.
Boo! I don't want to know that. I like imagining that she did cocaine. I thought snuff was a nickname for cocaine.
Me too. That's what I thought too. And then my friend was like, no, it's not good. And I was like, oh, yeah.
I told everyone the queen did cocaine.
Yeah. And so I loved her character and I loved all of her hair pieces. And there's like a great behind the scenes video of her in the makeup trailer, like seeing herself in a headpiece for the first time. And it's really awesome. But on the other end of that sword, man, Daphne's wigs are atrocious. And Antony's wigs and those like stupid sideburns.
I hate the sideburns. Every Regency period does this and it's not attractive to me. I just wanted to take a razor and just zzz, like it was like very Wolverine, like too much. I also just didn't think any of the men were hot. I don't know about you, but aside from obviously Simon.
That's another gripe that I have. It's a major gripe that I have because in the book, the brothers are supposed to be super fucking hot, okay? And they're all supposed to look alike. And Colin in particular is supposed to be the youngest. He's not the youngest, but he's like of the three of them, he's the youngest of Antony, Benedict, and Colin. And he's supposed to be kind of the most mischievous, the most, have the most swag, be the most adventurous. And he's also the closest with Daphne. And he has these green eyes and he's like super charming as well. And they made Colin in the show so fucking doofy with that stupid hair of his. It's like so big. And then he's like, Marina, I love you. I'll do anything to be with you. And I'm like, what the fuck? This is not the Colin of the book. No. And Antony's supposed to be super hot too. And I think the actors are really hot. They just had to wear those dumb wigs that really made them not hot.
Yeah, agreed. I didn't have many grapes, but one, it's not really a grape, but it's more of a question. Why does Netflix insist on doing the same fucking like intro graphics for every one of their originals? It makes sense for some of them, like The Crown, we do like a slow-mo shot of the different elements of The Crown, and then you kind of pan out and it's like The Crown and it's like really shiny. I don't need to see a slow-mo graphic of a tree and then things growing from the tree. Like fucking Pinocchio storybook time. Can we just do like the old school style where we do like cuts of the people like or nothing? I don't know. It's not working for me. And we don't need to do it for every single show is my point.
Well, I thought they just did the full credit scene on the pilot. And then for the rest of them, it's just like that quick Bridgerton like title card.
It just looks dumb. Like Game of Thrones, fine. We do like a really cool interactive map and we go to each town.
And it changes.
And it changes and it builds. But like, it's a fucking tree. And then there's like no significance to the tree. Like you kind of see a similar tree in the bedroom. One of the bedrooms at, I believe, Hastings House in London. Or maybe it's like supposed to be like the tree because of lineage and family is so important. But the way they did it just looked, I don't know, just that style of intro scenes is just like so overdone and I just need them to not do it anymore.
Netflix, take note. We're sick of it.
What else would you want to see in a season two?
I'm so sorry because I'm sure the actor is very nice, but I really want them to recast Colin.
Oh, damn. That's a poof. Okay. You're just going hard. Netflix, take note.
Yeah, I'm just really upset. I feel like, and it's just funny that I care this much because I literally like read the book yesterday, but Colin was one of the standout characters to me for some reason. He just seemed so fun and charming, and that's not what Colin is in the show. I don't want to spend any more time with show Colin. And he, you know, is going to have a bigger role later on. And so maybe rethink that.
Well, maybe you won't even get him until season three if they're following the sequence of the books and Antony's going to be focused. Because in the book, Colin had just come back from being abroad. And in the show, he's about to go abroad. So maybe they're pushing him out to season three.
Yeah, I mean, it would make sense for him to be in season four because his book is technically book four, if they're going book by book, season by season, but I don't know if they are or not. And another thing, the thing that I was also upset about was that they basically set up Benedict. They, like, set it up so he could be gay.
Yes! Then, oh my God, let's talk about it. Jesus Christ.
But then they didn't follow through and make him gay, and I'm like, why, guys? Why?
So wait, do you think they're doing a closet? Okay, so first of all, he gets, spoiler alert for the books, he gets married. So it doesn't seem like they do that pivot in the books. But I was wondering do you think it would be okay for them to go that far off script for the show?
Yeah, I want them to. I think it would still be true to the spirit of the book and be okay. And I would add more fuel to the fire in that respect too, because, so this is a spoiler that I just found out. I'm sorry. This is a spoiler for you as well. But the guy, Sir Philip, who comes in, takes Marina at the end, he's actually supposed to marry Eloise.
Eloise, yeah.
And I actually want Eloise to be a lesbian.
Ah, okay.
I mean, she has no interest in getting married. She doesn't want to get married.
There's always the one sister, right? There's the pretty sister who's the oldest, who's very traditional, very prim and proper. She's the blanking on her name in Little Women or in Pride and Prejudice, but she's that one. And then you also have the second sister who's like the spunky one who's always into books. Like, it's the same fucking archetypes, which I don't blame them for. It's very easy to get into the show and the characters because you're like, oh, it's that one. So my only point is that they do that several times without making them gay. But I also see what you're saying, which is that they're just going to kind of swap them and make one of them gay and leave the other one straight. But I guess that would be more subversive to make the woman gay.
I'm just getting some queer vibes. I want something to be followed through on. I mean, my ideal would be that both of them are gay. And like, not that like everybody is, you know, but Benedict and Eloise in particular have a really nice relationship because they're like on the swings together, like smoking the cigarettes. Yep. And it's like really, really cute.
They definitely preview it. Yeah. In that conversation, they both talk about being outside the bounds of societal expectations and all that stuff. I just thought it was really funny to your point that they went the like very, stereotype of doing, of making the artist gay.
Yes.
But then not doing it. But like clearly, like that's where they're headed.
Do it, guys. Netflix, do it. So let's go back to I Burn for You for a second. I'm curious. I assume, Dio, this was your first time watching anything that was adapted from a romance novel. It's your first kind of delving into the romance novel genre. How did you feel about the sexy talk?
Just like phrasing?
Yeah. I think that it feels so different reading it. Versus hearing people say it. And the I Burn for You line is actually a really nice nod to the book because it is written in the book, but it's not written as dialogue.
Interesting.
It's written as he burns for her.
Yeah, I did see that. Yeah, interesting. I think definitely watching other Regency era type of mostly movies and miniseries set me up for maybe not sexy talk, but kind of wooing talk in a very Jane Austen English way, right?
Yes.
You know, a lot of what I love about these types of, or what I love about kind of the Regency era genre, which we should talk about the fact that you like this and you notoriously do not like Regency era.
Yeah.
But is the wit, And that's what Julia Quinn is also, you know, being heralded for, is her wit. And I feel like that's usually the front and center of the banter between the two main leads. In Pride and Prejudice, the 2005 version, I believe, starring Keira Knightley, you know, you kind of feel, well, obviously there's first like the I'm not really interested in you classic hate to love arc, which right. Daphne and Simon, they don't hate each other, but she definitely gives off an air of like, I'm not swooning over you like every other girl in the room, which is both reflected in the book and in the show. But it's much shorter, I feel like, than other ones. But all to say that I feel like those types of novels and movies and miniseries have kind of prepared me for like, oh, this is what, you know, dating was like back then. And so it's not said in overt terms, although I Burn for You is pretty overt. It didn't make me feel weird. I feel like I'm coming into the world expecting there to be some odd choice of language and ways of expressing themselves. Different words haven't been invented yet, and they just feel things in a different way in period pieces. So It was fine. I didn't have particularly any feelings about it, but I'm sure you did. Tell me about them.
Oh, no, it made me extremely uncomfortable. I think the actors did the best that they could, you know, given the line. And they don't do a bad job. It's just sort of like if anybody were to actually say that to me, no. That would make me extremely, extremely uncomfortable. And it's funny because it feels so different when you read it. And I'm by no means a romance. I've said this a million times now, but I'm not a romance expert. I don't read a lot of it. I have been recently, but just because we're quarantined and it's fun stuff to read. But before this, really, I hadn't. I'd only read a couple for work. But even then, you kind of, there's a certain way about them and a certain dialogue that you come to expect and you just get used to it. And so trying to have that translated to the screen in a more sort of in your face mainstream way, in a less intimate way, it felt very, very uncomfortable to me.
Do you feel like it's particularly the kind of old timey phrasing, or in general, do you feel like, because, you know, I feel like Confessions of Love and whatever are very present in Grey's Anatomy and, you know, not even just particularly Shonda Rhimes things, but certainly hers. Do you feel like it's just those types of moments that make you uncomfortable, or just the I Burn for You is so both very, in a way, desperate and
it's
obvious.
So cheesy.
Yeah, and cheesy at the same time.
Yeah, it's like really nice in the context of a romance novel, but it's like, I just don't need to hear anybody say that out loud kind of thing. It's just like very like intimate and embarrassing, and it feels very like something that should be shared between two people and not outside, you know?
So, like, I'll give you an example, like, again, going back to the Pride and Prejudice. So this is at the very end of the movie. It's Mr. Darcy. And, you know, the whole movie, of course, they're, like, in love with each other and they don't want to admit it to themselves. And then finally gets to the point where they can't contain their feelings anymore. And so it comes out bursting from his body and he can't contain it. And he says something to the effect of, as I say these lines, like, I could envision him saying it because I've seen this scene so many times, but it's the part where he says, "You have bewitched me, body and soul," right? And, like, it doesn't come off, and obviously, like, my delivery, but when I watch that movie and I watch that scene, I love that scene. It's, like, first of all, it's in the rain, and he's, like, dripping, and, like, they're kind of, like, fighting, and then, like, they get into, like, these declarations of love, but, like, I don't know. I totally bought into that, and I know you're not really into Regency, so I don't know. What's your response to that line? And can you tell me why this Regency production didn't offend you?
Yeah, I hated that line. I think it's really odd because I love rom-coms. I would consider myself a romantic, but I'm very much more of a, I don't know what this says about me, but like when, you know, Daphne is on horseback and she is going to stop the duel and they almost shoot at her. And when Simon's the first one to like run after her and go take care of her, or like when her brothers are like, "I'm going to go stick up for your honor." That's the kind of shit that really pulls my heartstrings. I love all of that, and I love, I guess, more action-y things versus somebody kneeling in front of you trying to recite poetry. I guess it's a show don't tell thing.
Got it. Okay, I'm very interested to know how your one day marriage proposal is gonna go, because it's gonna have to involve words at some point.
If that happens, I don't think that's gonna happen, but if it happens, I don't know. Maybe they'll have to consult you about that.
It's just gonna have to be like fireworks or like, I don't know.
But even like I've thought about this. I like again, if I'm lucky enough to get married one day, which like it's not guaranteed, and if it doesn't happen, fine. But if it does, I think it's the kind of thing where it would be nice for it to just be just the two of us, like a simple kind of intimate thing, and not like a grand gesture.
Right, but do you want a speech? I guess is a
no.
Thing. Right, that's the thing. Is what I'm saying. Like. It's just going to be, you want it to be a just straightforward, kneel down, pop the question, and like, let's move on.
I don't know. This is weird. How did we get to like discussing my like fake proposal?
Okay, let's skip to the Regency part of the question. What about this? Again, you have said on record on the show, you're not really into the Regency era. It's one of the very few areas in which you and I diverge interests. What about this was different?
I think for some reason, it's really difficult for me to get into Regency era anything, which is the reason why, you know, my best friend's been recommending The Duke and I for years, and I, like, refuse to read it because I'm just not into historical Regency period romance. And Pride and Prejudice, I didn't like because it just feels very constricting to me. Very suffocating. Suffocating is the word. I feel very, like, suffocated in that environment. And so I don't like watching it. However, I think with Emma and with Bridgerton, I just think that they did such a good job of modernizing it and making the women have more agency. And like all the things that we talked about before, I love the music so much. I thought that that really did a lot to make it fresh. And I love the colors. I love how crisp and clean everything looked. And how beautiful everybody is. and also, like, it goes a long way that Reggae is as hot as he is. So it's all the superficial stuff. And we haven't even talked about this, but, like, Julie motherfucking Andrews as the narrator for Lady Mistledown. I mean, the stroke of genius.
Regency era Gossip Girl.
Yes, I love it so much. Was there anything else that really stuck out to you about the series? Were you surprised? I mean, did you like it overall? I'm assuming you did.
I liked it overall, for sure. It was very entertaining. I finished it in 2 days. I wouldn't say I got to the level of obsession as I think some people have, which is not a knock against anybody. I think the pacing was, again, a little bit to be desired. And also, I think I kind of came upon this realization, both with respect to this show as well as Wonder Woman 1984. I think the challenge for me, and it's kind of a good thing in a way, is that because we're coming out of the Trump era, and I feel like despite, you know, we're obviously, there's a lot of, COVID is still very much a big issue, especially in LA County where I am. You know, there is that light of the tunnel, and my headspace is definitely way different than even where I was 3 months ago. And someone brought up the point, I think it's Scott Galloway from Pivot, that, you know, in bad times, we want super fluff. We want light. We want comedies. In good times, you know, we tend to be drawn more towards serious things. And I think for me, I'm finally going through like a head change. Like last year, I read two books maybe in completion. I tried all year and I was just not in the headspace. Quarantine brain, like Black Lives Matter. So many things happened last year that were extremely dispiriting. And it was just really tough. And I finally picked up a book. I'm reading Minor Feelings, finally. And it's amazing. And I think I'm just gravitating more towards a little bit more back to the meaty stuff, which is, again, not a knock against romance or superhero movies, but they do tend to be lighter and they do come with a different set of expectations in terms of how it's going to entertain you. And so I think for me, what I'm discovering is I think what I'm looking for, what I feel like I'm craving and needing in media these days is just shifting a little bit as things are finally starting to kind of lift. And so I think that's why I'm responding to these movies and shows as I am, which is to say, still enjoying them, but, you know, maybe not in as much of a need for like the complete fluff and kind of craving a little bit more of the meatier stuff. That's why I'm kind of like pushing for like, well, let's talk about race and like, let's, you know, all these things, which may not be appropriate for those things. And so I think that's kind of part of where I'm coming from. So I definitely liked it. I would like, if it's possible, I don't know how they're going to fit this in, but they don't seem to have a problem of creating new characters, of seeing a little bit more prominence for a Black family. You know, they do have the characters of Lady Danbury and the Queen, either going further like into those histories, maybe flashback scenes of how the Queen and George were courting, Lady Danbury's life, something, or choosing a Black family to be one of the families that are part of the courtship of maybe Anthony or, you know, some of the other children. I think that would go a little bit more further than they're kind of currently going. That would be my wish for season two.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think that makes total sense about what kind of media you're consuming and the shift that's happening right now. I think it's funny because for me, the way that I'm coping is reading all of these romance novels. And I'm not just reading like this. I'm also reading a lot of fantasy romance and like a lot of stuff that I don't normally read because it's like all I can handle. But it's also making me feel like I may or may not have really unrealistic expectations about sex whenever we get out of quarantine.
So, that's really funny. Will you be continuing with the Julia Quinn series or would you prefer to just watch the rest of it out unfold on TV?
I really fell in love with the Bridgerton family, especially at the end of the book. The siblings all have such a lovely dynamic with each other. And so, yeah, I'm definitely going to read the second book. That's Antony's book. I believe it's called The Viscount Who Loved Me. But I don't know about the rest of it, but I'm pretty set on reading at least a couple more.
Yeah, I'm only a few chapters in because I just got the book yesterday, but I do feel like I could pretty easily breeze through Duke and I. Mm-hmm. And I guess I do want more context as to some of their inner monologue, as you said, because to be frank, like some of the conflict seemed foolish and unnecessary a lot of the time in the show. This is seriously the only thing keeping you guys apart, which is not uncharacteristic for either Regency nor romance, but it was a little confusing sometimes because it was just, it felt weird. Like there's that whole episode where they like get married and they don't talk to each other for 3 days and they constantly have this face like from The Graduate of like where you can't really read what they're feeling. And it went on for like a really long time. And then, of course, like they finally like consummate their marriage at the end. But all before that, you're like not really sure what they're feeling.
I know.
Like, and so it was strange. And I'd love to kind of get a better sense of what they were thinking at that time. So I'm definitely going to be reading the first one. I don't know if I'll, you know, completely go through the rest. But to your point, I think it was definitely kind of like how Scream was like a nice segue into horror. I feel like this Duke and I has been a good bridge into romance and kind of definitely... And in a similar way that I feel like young adult maybe had a stigma against it a few years ago until it started having big hits, like is definitely presenting romance in a different light maybe to me. So, and hopefully others.
So happy.
Yeah.
I'm glad you're going to read it. And I think that the first book too, it's a really fun, quick read. Like Julia Quinn's writing it's very tight and sharp and it's fun to read. And I just fell in love with all the characters. So I would highly recommend.
Yeah, and I'm just on a final note, it's interesting because I'm curious how, have you heard of Passion Flicks?
No, what's that?
So Passion Flicks is basically like the Netflix for romance movies. Ooh. It was started by Elon Musk's sister, Tosca, and it's kind of been, yeah, the niche D2C platform for that genre. And similarly, she's, I think, kind of spoken on behalf of the romance genre industry and trying to dispel this myth and very much trying to create that narrative a little bit to what you're speaking about in terms of like the empowerment of women in these books and trying to kind of change the misconceptions about it. So I'm curious if this in a small way, either directly or indirectly, will have a cascading effect on that business. Because it has been around for a little while, but hasn't really hit a mass audience yet. But who knows? This could be the start of it.
That's really interesting. I had no idea that this existed. Now I'm curious. So
there you go.
So, yeah, there we go. All right. We'll be back soon. If you guys don't follow us already, please follow us at RepeakPod on Twitter and Instagram. Please leave us a review, 5 stars if you're so obliged. And that's another thing. I really wish that people still spoke like they did in Regency times now.
Oh, I've definitely been giving my dog a Regency era voice this entire weekend. So
we'll be back in a couple weeks.
See ya.
Bye.